Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to be talking about a development this week that has been much anticipated, and whether it has lived up to the advanced billing or not is somewhat to be determined. But to give us the best advice available on the meeting between the Chinese emperor, as I call him, Xi Jinping, and his asset, as our colleague and friend Sam Faddis calls him, Joe Biden, the president of the United States, on the margins of the Asia-Pacific Economic Council meeting in San Francisco. And who better to talk about all of that than our friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, Bradley Thayer. Dr. Thayer is one of the most accomplished academics, scholars, authors, essayists on subjects that involve China. He is most recently the co-author with Ilan Chao Han of Understanding the China Threat, and has a new book that will be out shortly with his colleague and ours, Captain James Fennell. And we are anxious to take a look at that, but especially anxious to get an immediate assessment of what has gone down in San Francisco this week, Brad, as best we can make sense of it, but also a bit of the history of these kinds of events. We're often told that the personal chemistry between these leaders is so important. I'm anxious to get your thoughts on that as well. So welcome back, sir. It's always good to have you with us.
Frank, it's a pleasure to join you today.
So let's start, I guess, with that sort of macro picture. Is it fair to say that even when one's leader, in this case Joe Biden, is on top of his game and on your side, these sort of diplomatic duets don't generally amount to much of advantage, at least to the democracy in question, sometimes for the benefit of the totalitarians, but not so much for us. Is that historically fair, based on your rendering?
Absolutely, it is, Frank. There's no reason to have these bilateral meetings whatsoever. At best, they have a marginal effect on anything advancing any policy. At worst, they have a deleterious effect. We can think of when Kennedy met Khrushchev at Vienna in 1961, where Khrushchev measured him and found him wanting, and thus was able to recognize that Kennedy was not Eisenhower, and that he would move against to build the Berlin Wall and then also to put missiles in Cuba, because he saw Kennedy as a weak American leader, in contrast to Eisenhower. We have, with the meeting that we had this week, a similar disaster, where you had an emperor, Xi Jinping, coming to a capital in many respects on American soil, where he was feted by the people, brushed in, as we know, and then also by the Biden administration. For what purpose? Well, Xi's purpose was quite clear, and that was to meet with the 400 business leaders who are bailing him out and whom he needs, and their behavior.
And each of whom paid $40,000 for the privilege of doing so at the dinner event there the other night.
And their behavior was appalling, that people who call themselves Americans would sit down with the enemy was beyond measure. I call these, in a piece I'll have coming out, American secessionists, because they have seceded from the United States, in essence. They live on American soil, but they are completely disconnected from American political culture, American history, the understanding of what they owe to previous generations of Americans, and they've seceded. They're interested in wealth maximization and having more homes and more boats and other advantages of wealth. But they are not interested in advancing American security.
Wow. So I guess secessionist is a rather well, understated way of criticizing them. I mean, treachery, treason, betrayal are terms that come to my mind as well. And Brad, as you say, if the stakes weren't so high, this would be just deplorable. But as it is, it really seems to me, well, as we talk about in our book, The Indictment, it's prosecutable, or should be at least. So to the extent that this is going on in the backdrop, are you suggesting that really the meeting with Biden was just, you know, window dressing for the real purpose of the thing, which was to engage with people who could help China at a very difficult pass, specifically the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, we'd say the Biden administration was the doormat. He had to cross the transom to get what he really wanted, which was the meeting with business leaders who will bail him out, right? Xi's in dire straits domestically. His economy has collapsed, and he needs American investment and trade. As Roger Robinson, of course, our great colleague, has stressed time and again, if that were removed from him, there would be the possibility to topple him and the Chinese Communist Party. So that was, for Xi Jinping, the center of gravity of this meeting. Biden administration was essentially that meeting with an administration which is so friendly to him. Frank, as we have talked about many times, there's a reason why the Biden administration is so friendly to Xi Jinping, as you well have noted and captured in the indictment, your book. Which is captures it very well, which is Biden is bought and paid for by Xi Jinping. And so the idea that there would be any progress in substantive progress in trade, to use our leverage in trade or investment or in artificial intelligence, is simply not going to advance. Instead, you have the gossamer of climate change, of a purported fentanyl agreement, right, which is absurd. Absurd for fundamentally because any agreement with a communist entity is a pie crust made to be broken. There's no way he's going to keep any agreement with fentanyl. It's a weapon to be used against us, and he wants to kill us. So there's no reason whatsoever that he would stop the export of precursor chemicals and opioids to Mexico coming through an open border, which is another policy of the Biden administration, which has disastrous consequences. So
Brad, are you of the view that if he wanted to, Xi Jinping could stop the transfer of those precursor chemicals, could make this fentanyl crisis, if not go away entirely, much more tractable?
Of course he could stop that. Of course the party could. Xi Jinping controls the party. This is, in essence, a one-party state. If he wanted to, of course he could arrest it immediately.
And in part because of the situational awareness about it all. If they're not actually organizing and running it, which is my view, but they certainly, with the social credit system, have the ability to interdict it, do they not?
He leads an advanced superpower, a surveillance superpower. He has a well-honed secret police that have practiced their skills in the anti-corruption campaign. And all of those tools, as well as others, could be employed against businesses that are engaged in this activity, either directly or through third parties. So, of course, he could stop it if he wanted to. He doesn't want to stop it. So the gossamer of a purported agreement in fentanyl, or the gossamer of climate change, making a progress. What John Kerry was doing there, of course, is just added to the surrealism of that occasion.
Again, it'd be comical if it weren't so serious. Brad, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about those two other purported accomplishments of the exercise. The military-to-military contacts, and also artificial intelligence. We'll be right back with more with Bradley Thayer. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. You wouldn't have known it from the red carpet treatment Chinese dictator Xi Jinping received in San Francisco 2 weeks ago from President Joe Biden, California Governor Gavin Newsom, and 400 corporate leaders. But until recently, their guest was stealthily operating a biolab with potential weapons of mass destruction near Fresno. A chilling report subsequently issued by the House Committee on the Chinese Communist Party confirmed that this facility was replete with samples of 20 deadly pathogens, the equipment to replicate them, and mice genetically modified to spread COVID-19. In the hands of any of the thousands of apparent People's Liberation Army Special Forces personnel who have illegally entered this country in recent months, such diseases could have been unleashed with devastating effect. And we have no idea if there are other labs like this still operating in America. Thanks, G. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. Dr. Bradley Thayer, the co-author of Understanding the China Threat, is helping us understand the China threat, particularly as manifested in this week's excursion by the Emperor of China, the communist dictator, as even Joe Biden has called him, Xi Jinping, to the United States to take stock of how he's doing in taking over San Francisco. I have to say the arrival event was pretty spectacular. The Chinese arrived in force and lots of black limousines and Suburbans and the like. But to the larger point, to what end? And Brad, you were, I think, helping us calibrate this so-called agreement to work on fentanyl interdiction. Talk to me about the question of military-to-military contacts and the idea that we're going to now be much better prepared against the possibility of accidental conflict because we're talking to one another through such channels.
Well, the Biden administration places enormous emphasis on military-to-military contacts, which were terminated by the which had existed before, but were terminated by the Chinese when Speaker of the House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan in August of 2022. Since that time, the Biden administration has worked assiduously to reestablish those connections, seeing that as a valuable source of exchange of communication. That will lead to misperception in the Biden administration's mind. In fact, military-to-military exchanges are deleterious for American national security because they convey knowledge to the Chinese, to the People's Liberation Army.
That knowledge. So this is not so much the hotlines whereby they can talk to one another when a Chinese aircraft threatens to bring down one of ours or that sort of thing. You're talking about exercises. You're talking about visits to military installations and the like.
To aircraft carriers, to ports, to American vessels, to American bases and posts worldwide. We can think of it as meeting between military colleagues from the United States Army and the People's Liberation Army, or the our Navy and the People's Liberation Army Navy. So these collegial relationships, if the PRC were not the enemy, might be advantageous. For example, as we have mill to mill with countries around the world, and in South America and Africa, and of course with our allies, of course, where that you have an alliance relationship or a major non-NATO ally or NATO allied relationship. So these contact, military-to-military relationships are greatly emphasized by the Biden administration, but it's a way of essentially transmitting knowledge, practices, insights, advice, help, intelligence, in essence, from American military to the People's Liberation Army. So if they were, it's only a pity they were not ended permanently with Nancy Pelosi's visit. Pelosi did little good, but one of the things that she did do is essentially lead to the suspension of Mill to Mill.
Let me just ask you, because the thing, we talked a little bit about this the other day with Grant Newsom, and he made the point that it's even made worse by the fact that it's not reciprocal. That basically, we're giving the Chinese access to all this information, as you put it, and they're not showing us theirs. You know, what's up with that?
Indeed, they're not sharing information. It is one way, even though purportedly it is a two-way. But the Chinese military officers, of course, will not share any information, of course, on pain of great punishment. So they're there to learn. They're there to observe. They're there to exploit the information that American submariners or essentially American military officers are there to convey. So it's an egregious policy that should have never been restarted. And so, again, the fact that Xi Jinping uses that policy as leverage because he knows the Biden administration wants it desperately and is plays in a very coy fashion until the Biden administration now is going to tout a great success that Mill to Mill has been restarted, even though it hurts us, is a succinct and perfectly captures the Biden administration.
It does.
What they perceive as a victory, of course, is a loss for the United States and the loss of American power.
Yeah. And what one might expect, actually, from an asset of the Chinese Communist Party, if, in fact, that moniker fits. Brad, let me ask you quickly about artificial intelligence. Is there any prospect that an effort to assure that there isn't some untoward upshot from this technology is going to redound to our benefit?
Well, there is. The United States should have no contact with the PRC and artificial intelligence in this realm whatsoever. In the antecedent technologies, the technologies, in the ethics, the norms, and the principles of it. The Chinese Communist Party will use AI to as a tool to better and more effectively achieve their hegemony in international politics while more effectively crushing the Chinese people, essentially human rights activists, those who suffer under the tyranny of the Chinese Communist Party within China, in the diaspora, and in other countries as well. So we should do nothing to assist them in this regard at all. Again, any agreement with the party is going to be broken. It will only they will use it as a tool to fetter us and to demand that we abide by the agreement while they ignore the agreement and do what they were going to do anyway.
Standard operating procedure.
And it is for communist states.
We're going to facilitate it is outrageous. Listen, let me just finally ask you, Brad, there are a couple of things that I believe should have been front and center in this conversation and almost certainly were not even mentioned. One is that we've had revelation that among the toxic substances found in that Chinese-owned biological warfare laboratory in California, and heavens only knows how many more there are, was, I think, Ebola and HIV, communicable diseases, in other words, along with the mice that could be used to move them about. We've also had, you know, the problem of these Chinese nationals. We talked with, we'll be talking with Todd Bensman about this in a moment, coming into this country who look a lot like special operations personnel. And finally, not least, the kind of arson, I'm calling Xi an arsonist, that these kinds of things might allow him to engage in inside our country, should he choose to do so.
Indeed, Frank, what he's doing is he's essentially putting men in place. He already has biological weapons in place in these labs. He's working through TikTok and other means to ensure there's communication. There's a way to undermine us in many different respects, but you have connectivity through a TikTok and other means. So you have capabilities in place, and you have the men to use those capabilities in place through that biological weapons lab, as well as old-fashioned means, such as traditional mechanisms and ways of sabotage and sowing essentially dissension within the United States, interrupting essentially the infrastructure upon which we depend, and sowing chaos in the U.S. when they so choose.
When they so choose, and we have to leave it at that. Whether they will choose to do so in the near future remains to be seen, but Brad Thayer is on the case, and we hope you'll give us a heads up if it goes that way. Brad Thayer, thank you so much for your work, as well as your visit.
Thank you, Frank. It was my pleasure.
And for joining us for our webinar on all of these subjects that will be taking place shortly. God bless you. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and it's a very great pleasure to have with us for the first time, I believe, James Hearson. He is a columnist for Newsmax.com, as well as a best-selling New York Times best-selling author, no less, with some of his Tales from the Left Coast, as well as another book entitled Hollywood Nation. James is a man who caught my attention because he'd written a thoughtful piece, I think, about the need to give Speaker of the House Mike Johnson a little bit of time to get the job done of turning the country around. A lot of us on the right have been, shall we say, rather impatient with him. The left has been, of course, viciously attacking him relentlessly, notably for his faith, James. And I wanted to give you a chance, as a man who has a sense of all of this, to explain, particularly to those who've been critical of this sort of stopgap continuing resolution that he engineered, to continue to give him some time.
Yeah, we used to call that, Frank, a honeymoon. And he's certainly had no honeymoon with the left and a very short one with the right. And some segments of the right are looking at this, I believe, in a pragmatic way, which is what I would say. You know, it's, first of all, he took over a very tough position at a very difficult time with very minimal leverage. And I think that's the key, of course, when we look at what goes on in Congress with these budget negotiations. It's all about the leverage. And actually, I would say, considering the leverage that Speaker Johnson has, how small it is, he actually accomplished a great deal in this this budget deal, this continuing resolution that was signed. he bifurcated it. So there's, I think it's four appropriations bills in one section and the other eight in the other section with different deadlines to break it up a bit. And it's there's no increases in it, which from, you know, from a conservative fiscal responsibility point of view, that's not like something to, you know, have confetti, but it's a somewhat of a positive if you keep things the same, as people know who've looked at Washington, where things constantly are raised. I mean, obviously, Congress never passes.
You're talking about the budget ceiling, basically, for these appropriations measures.
Right. And the other thing is, he did not include, which increases his leverage, any funding for either Ukraine or Israel, which he himself, in terms of Israel, has made it a priority in his rhetoric. But I think he did this too, because we have this short, the first deadline comes up January 19th, which is very close. And he promised, one of the things he promised when he was elected speaker is that he would, there are 12 appropriation segments that, unlike his predecessors, including Speaker McCarthy, he's going to break those up. This has been Congressman Matt Gaetz's big picture issue with the budget. Break them up into 12, so let's say they're bite-sized chunks. And there's a huge advantage if he can do that. It's difficult, but I think this bifurcated deal makes it a lot more possible, for me, my perspective, than him having shut down the government, which was the only other option. This way, he's got it bifurcated, and he can perhaps, you know, wrangle breaking it up further when we talk about next year's budget. What's happened, Frank? And we've seen it over and over again.
Can I just say, James, we're kind of into the weeds for most people's purposes, I suspect. Okay. And I guess the thing that I want to just make sure we take away before we turn to the attacks that have been levied against him, particularly for his faith, I think it's fair to say, especially on the left, is that he's trying, I think it's fair to say, he's trying to do the regular order of appropriations measures. He's bought himself a little bit more time to do that. The trouble is, just in the space of the past week or two, three different versions of those appropriations measures have not gotten, you know, the rule that they need to be taken up on the floor, which I understand basically is a result of people who are looking for, you know, fiscal discipline, budget cuts, being unhappy with the growth or at least the continued high spending. Is it realistic in your estimation, James, that the speaker will be able to get the other, whatever it is, eight of those measures, you know, through the House, and the Senate hasn't done one of them, as best I can tell. So what are the prospects here realistically, do you think?
Well, I think it's difficult, but I think it can be done. And I think his CR actually makes it more likely. And here, you know, if we look at what's happened in the past, they let those appropriation bills pile up so that they were big logjam at the end of the year. And then what we got is the monster omnibus, which really is just saying, we're going to throw everything in. So if you object to anything in there, you have to vote against the whole thing. It's absurd. And then, of course, it was passed without people reading it. But
we'll know what's in it after we pass it, I think, was Nancy Pelosi's famous
phrase. That's absolutely right. And so I think he has a better shot at avoiding the omnibus. And it's actually remarkable that he was able to do those things that he did, have the bifurcation, the short deadline, and not have, they call it supplemental, but what it means is funding Ukraine, funding Israel. And so that creates more of an urgency and gives him additional leverage, gives the Republicans additional leverage. I mean, they have such a thin majority And there's so many people who are in the Republican Congress who caucus who are ready to jump to the other side, which was proven recently with the attempted Mayorkas impeachment bill.
Right.
So that's,
well,
that's
some would argue with the CR itself, the continuing resolution. And there is this uniparty phenomenon that we're all very frustrated with, needless to say. But speaking of which, let me ask you, James, because I think that you're approaching it as I do from the perspective of being impressed by Mike Johnson, whom, frankly, I'd never heard of before he suddenly became the speaker, but who has quite a record of service in his previous incarnation with our friends at the Alliance Defending Freedom as a litigator, very, you know, conservative champion of religious freedom, about which I care a lot. Now a politician, now trying, though, to bring, you know, sort of a biblical faith-centered, principled approach to his current role. He's been just viciously attacked for doing so by the left. What does that say about, more generally, the left's hostility towards people of faith? And where does it likely leave him with respect to governance?
Well, the left has a hostility to God. They have a hostility to theism. And of course, Mike Johnson's evangelical Christian faith is just even beyond that. So I guess the word that we use is triggered. And it's been oppo research. I mean, the mainstream media have been treating Mike Johnson like a political opponent. They go into his past. They dig up statements of faith, things that he's done, even when he and his son used computer software together on a program in his church to avoid pornography. They snarkily attacked him for that. But the thing they forget is the Judeo-Christian principles that he talks about that are in the Bible are foundational principles of our founding documents. They're inherent in our birth certificate, the Declaration of Independence. They're inherent in the provisions of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. Our founding fathers quoted the Bible constantly, and presidents have, particularly the most famous presidents. And so what he's really talking about are foundational principles of America. He is not, as the critics try to do in the media, seeking to create a theocracy. That's the name of the game for the left in demonizing Mike
specifically. Johnson. Yeah, they have, I guess, trotted out this idea of a what's called a new apostolic reformation as a vehicle for ending the separation of church and state, as they put it. Can you speak to that briefly? We've got 20 seconds.
The separation of church and state, as Mike Johnson points out, that phrase is not in the Constitution. It's in Supreme Court cases. And if you're dedicated to religious freedom, which Mike Johnson, as you pointed out, with his legal career, who did mostly appellate work, but some trial work, and dealt with constitutional principles, not just freedom of religion, but freedom of speech, but that's a central focus of our founding documents, of Mike Johnson's litigation, and of every fiber of his being. And so the idea that he would impose, you know, a religious belief is absurd. He's exactly the opposite of that.
We have to leave it at that for the moment, James. This is a topic to which I hope we might return. I think it's important that we get this properly calibrated and stand with people of principled faith in our country that we've been privileged, I think, to have take a leadership role at this critical moment. God bless you, my friend. We'll talk with you soon.
God bless you.
We'll be right back with more on the other side of this break. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. You wouldn't have known it from the red carpet treatment Chinese dictator Xi Jinping received in San Francisco 2 weeks ago from President Joe Biden, California Governor Gavin Newsom, and 400 corporate leaders. But until recently, their guest was stealthily operating a biolab with potential weapons of mass destruction near Fresno. A chilling report subsequently issued by the House Committee on the Chinese Communist Party confirmed that this facility was replete with samples of 20 deadly pathogens, the equipment to replicate them, and mice genetically modified to spread COVID-19. In the hands of any of the thousands of apparent People's Liberation Army Special Forces personnel who have illegally entered this country in recent months, such diseases could have been unleashed with devastating effect. And we have no idea if there are other labs like this still operating in America. Thanks, G. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to Todd Bensman, always a welcome guest here and in most other quarters in which people care about, among other things, our border insecurity and the implications for the entire country, which is now comprised, as our guest is fond of pointing out, of 50 border states. His name is Todd Bensman. He is the Senior National Security Fellow at the highly regarded Center for Immigration Studies, the author of not one but two best-selling books, Overrun, most recently, and one that has become, in some ways, and required reading again, and that is America's Covert Border Wars, which talks about, well, jihadists trying to get into our country and what the United States government is trying to do to prevent it, or at least what it was trying to do back when that book was written. Not so much anymore, I don't think. Todd Bensman, it's great to have you. Welcome back, sir.
Good to be here as always. Thank you.
You rendered an incalculably important public service, it seems to me. I mean, your writings and commentaries and interviews are all vitally important, Todd, but you drew upon your own background in law enforcement intelligence in the Department of Public Safety in your native state of Texas to exhume a document that I think is incredibly important called Attachment A. Tell us the story on that one quickly, if you can, and what it tells us about the enemy within problem at the moment.
Yeah, Attachment A comes from a very important landmark federal prosecution in Dallas, Texas, about 15 years ago, when the government prosecuted the purveyors of the largest Hamas fundraising operation in the United States history for a terrorist organization, for Hamas. It's called the Holy Land Foundation. The six defendants in that, seven defendants, two of them are fugitives, five of them were ultimately convicted of material support for Hamas, sentenced to prison terms like, 40, 50, 60 years, and they are still in prison. But what the government did for us back in those days is they left a trail of breadcrumbs in the form of a document called Attachment A, which is unindicted co-conspirators. These are the people that they just didn't have the bandwidth, and organizations that were supporting the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas through the Muslim Brotherhood in InfoWars and fundraising and influence peddling and a variety of support functions inside the United States, propaganda, etc., and laid out that these could be prosecuted at some point by somebody. The groups and people that were named in this, there are 246 people and groups. Some of them have died, some of them have moved on, but quite a few of them are still alive and well and doing the same things that they were doing at the time that they made this list of unindicted co-conspirators. And so I thought it would be a useful right about now to remind people that there is a trail of breadcrumbs out there that the FBI, that federal prosecutors could, if there was ample predicate, criminal predicate, maybe take a second look at about what they're doing and that sort of thing. And that ran in the New York Post just recently.
No, it's a very, very widely seen, I think, because of its timeliness as well as its content. And, you know, the thing about it is it's kind of a blueprint for the Muslim Brotherhood infrastructure in this country. You mentioned a guy I've interacted with a little bit, James Jacks, who was at the time the federal prosecutor on the case. I personally believe that the idea was that they were going to begin prosecution of those unindicted co-conspirators under his office's auspices once they put away the five guys that they were starting out with in the Holy Land Foundation. And alas, Barack Obama was elected president, and that was the end of that. And I fear that it was, you know, what would make it a non-starter to get a prosecution going, at least at the federal level, even now. But it's so concerning, and I really appreciate, again, you're bringing it to all of our attention, because unfortunately it would be bad enough if that were the full extent of it, but we ought to be doing something about it at least.
Yeah,
but unfortunately, as you pointed out through some of your other writings over the years, there's a counterpart to, if you will, the Sunni jihadist infrastructure and threat inside our country. Talk a little bit about the Shia strain.
Sure. Real quickly, before we move on, I just want to point out that one of the most prominent organizations on Attachment A is the Council of Arab Islamic Fair Care.
American Islamic Relations. Yep.
Yes, I'm sorry if I didn't quite get that right. But I just wanted to mention them because they are very prominent right now as a propaganda arm of Hamas inside the United States. They're on that list. They challenged that their name on their place on that list and lost at every stage. So I just want to point out that they're very prominent again right now in the conflict right now. But
they're prominent because they were purpose built to be the, you know, sort of face of Hamas in the United States. That was demonstrated, I think you made this point in your Post article, to the satisfaction of a federal judge who, when they came to him saying, "Oh, no, you have to take us off this list of unindicted co-conspirators," right, said, "No, not only am I keeping you on the list, I'm publishing the list," which was a very important
And I was able to, I actually was able to track down Jim Jacks, the chief prosecutor on that case. He's in private practice now, of course, like a lot of former U.S. attorneys. And he granted me an interview about this whole list. And that's also cited in the document. That guy did a big public service with that case. Moving to the Shia.
We're going to have to take a break in just a moment, but let me just set the stage for it, because people have been encouraged to believe that the Sunnis and the Shia hate each other so much that they can't collaborate. But I think what you're going to lay out for us on the other side of the break is not only are they collaborating in places like the Middle East at the moment, but they've got the capacity to do so here as well. We'll talk about the Shia footprint, sponsored by Iran, doing business as Hezbollah inside the United States, with Todd Bensman right after this. Stay tuned. Welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with one of the great, well, public servants, I think it's fair to say, a man who was a journalist for a time. He worked in the Department of Public Safety in Texas as one of their intelligence analysts. These days, he works for a wonderful think tank, the Center for Immigration Studies. But throughout, it's a real public service that he has been providing us, especially with his monitoring of what is happening to our border, which is, as he says in his best-selling new book, overrun. And that is directly as a result of the Biden administration's policies. We've been talking a bit about the subject of your previous book, America's Covert Border Wars. Talk to me about the threat we see from the Shia version of these jihadis operating in the United States, Hezbollah.
Right. It is definitely Hezbollah. They are the most dangerous U.S.-designated terror group in the world, as far as I'm concerned, the ones that bear the most watching. The issue with them right now at times like this is that they have an arm, a clandestine foreign service arm of sleeper cells inside the United States, often known as Unit 910 or the IGO, the Islamic Jihadist Organization. And the way they work is they are trained, equipped, paid to embed themselves in U.S. society, in major cities, and to build target lists and the capability to execute on those target lists when the word comes from Tehran or Beirut to do so. We know this because we have caught them in the act here in the United States and prosecuted them. About 5 years ago, I did a three-part series about Unit 910 based on two major court cases where the prosecutors just absolutely loaded it up way above and beyond the call of duty with granular details about how they operate here in the United States and what they are prepared to do at all times, which is to kill people and attack physical targets on the ground here. They are very much alive and well. We know this because they're not just in the United States, they're throughout Latin America, and the Brazilians, along with the Israeli Mossad and FBI, have all just busted a bunch of them and thwarted a major terror plot in Brazil. That is something that we should expect to see a lot more of lately. Remember, the United States has two aircraft carrier groups right now off the coast of Israel with the stated purpose of suppressing Hezbollah rocket attacks or invasion on Israel's northern border. That is a red flag moment to Hezbollah. They may not take well to that, especially if this thing escalates. And that is something we need to really watch. Unit 910, Hezbollah. You can find those three stories. I originally published them at PJ Media. They're still there. They're also on my website at toddbensman.com. Incredible detail about Unit 910 in the United States.
Well, you're absolutely right, Todd. We should be watching them. Is there any evidence that the FBI is? Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, in testimony before, I think it was the Senate Appropriations Committee the other day, profess that, you know, we're not tracking these networks. Is that right? I mean, I'm really concerned about the state of our counterintelligence, but what's your take on it?
I haven't been in the intelligence business in 5 years or so, but when I was with the Texas Department of Public Safety, I did the counterterrorism programming and operations for the state of Texas. And we work very closely with six FBI offices, field offices in Texas, and they all used to have Hezbollah groups. That's all they did was Hezbollah, Houston, Dallas, San Antonio.
They were on top of Hezbollah.
They were 5 or 6 years ago. Under this administration, who knows? I'm not like really plugged in anymore, but I would hope that they are, that they still are, no matter what Christopher Wray says.
Yeah. Well, I hope they are too. And the evidence that suggests they're not is in part they're chasing off after people like us, I think, as much as
we're white supremacists.
That's what I'm talking about. But they're not that we're white supremacists, let the record show, but they to people like us that if you don't like what an open border looks like, that's evidence of white supremacism, which of course is
crazy. That still doesn't even occur to me that that's, but yeah, you're right.
It's what they do. Yeah. But more to the point, Todd, I think we've also seen them off, you know, covering for Joe Biden and the like, which is an inappropriate use of counterintelligence capabilities, to say the least. Let me turn to one other aspect of your beat that is a real concern, as well as these jihadis that have come here in large numbers and are clearly now disseminated all over the United States and capable of doing all kinds of harm to us, from sabotage to assassinations to insurrections, who knows. There seems to be at least as many, or as much capability, I should say, at least, in the persons of Chinese nationals, unaccompanied, military-aged men seem to be coming up here. I think you've laid eyes on some of them in what appear to be units, no less, with similar kit and the like. All tells, from an intelligence point of view, that those could well be People's Liberation Army personnel, maybe even special operators. What could possibly go wrong with that, Todd? Is that in fact happening in your estimation? And how serious a problem do you think that is?
I mean, I've said this before. There are a lot of Chinese men coming over the border right now, thousands, tens of thousands, really, in the last year. I think that probably the majority of them are going to be economic migrants trying to kind of upgrade. But the issue is that the PLA and the Chinese Communist Party, they really emphasize espionage and spying on us. They use all of our visa programs, F1, the cultural exchange visas, the tourist visas and everything, to student visas, that's the F1, to insert operatives in our universities and close to our military and to steal secrets and turn them over. And this has been going on for years and years. We have lots of prosecutions in the last few years. I would be more surprised than not that they weren't slipping a few in over the border. Like, why wouldn't you do that? Of course you would do that.
If it's only a few, it would be one thing. I think you're right. It's larger numbers than that. But Todd, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your time. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.